Welcome to Medicus, a student-run podcast about any and all things in the world of medicine. Follow along as we interview outstanding individuals about important topics in healthcare.
Welcome back to the Medicus podcast. My name is Griffin Johnson, and today I am pleased to have the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Gregory Gruner. Dr. Gruner attended Loyola University Chicago's Stritch School of Medicine for medical school, and he completed his residency in neurology at Loyola University Medical Center. He then went on to complete fellowships in electroencephalography at the University of Illinois at Chicago, electrophysiology at the University of Iowa, and peripheral nerve disease at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Gruner also holds Master of Business Administration and Master of Health Professions Education degrees. Currently, he is a practicing neurologist at Loyola University Medical Center and the Vice Dean for Education at Loyola University Chicago Stritch School of Medicine. Dr. Gruner, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
To start things off, are there any gaps in that bio that you'd like to clarify? Or
no, it's good. It's good. I like how you collapsed all those years into a few sentences, so
well,
thank you.
I was just saying before we sat down, that's a lot of education that's gone on in these last years, I'm sure. And I said, I don't think I'll be doing as much education. And he said, well, you never know where you're going to go. So essentially for background, I'm a first-year med student, and I think I speak for a lot of new med students when I say that the way we're learning in medical school is much different than the way we've learned in any previous education. Prior to starting, everyone said, oh, it's like drinking water from a fire hose. It's a challenge, and it's a new type of challenge. And so sometimes while I'm studying, I find myself questioning why we're learning, what we're learning, and I can't help but wonder how the preclinical curriculum is developed. So I'm thrilled to be sitting down with you today and gain some insight on those questions. So to start things off, you are the Vice Dean for Education here at Stritch. Could you elucidate what that entails?
We used to jokingly say that my role was implementing vision. So really what my big role is, as we have a strategy for achieving different educational outcomes, our curricular changes, that's where I provide most of my oversight. And I work with the other educational deans in the Office of Medical Education up here on the third floor to make sure we accomplish all those goals.
Okay. So as far as your position, how big of an impact do you have on the preclinical curriculum as far as like what does that look like?
Sure. One thing I think all students should be aware of is that the whole curriculum, whole design of the curriculum is actually under the control of a committee. And that committee is a central curricular authority, the CCA. Mm-hmm. And that's chaired by Dr. Teresa Krista Paytas. She also runs the pathology course in the second year. So the reason I bring that up is because they're responsible for looking at the different outcomes we're supposed to achieve, different curriculums which individuals or committees or outside organizations say we have to implement, and then figuring out how we're going to do that. So she helps to organize that. She also sits on or actually controls individuals or other committees which report back to her. And one of those committees is an assessment committee, a longitudinal outcomes committee. So a lot of different committees, again, are within or under the purview of the CCA. And the CCA is sort of interesting because they don't report to me. They directly report to the dean of the medical school. So my part is really sort of working with them as they design or look at things and seeing how can we accomplish the goals or outcomes that they develop or that they feel that we have to develop. And then also from there, then working with the faculty in different departments within the hospital, within the basic science group, you know, to make sure we can accomplish all those goals. So I guess I'm sort of the go-between person, just to make sure that we accomplish all of these things.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's a lot of people involved in this. And there's a lot of people that kind of give the go-ahead when things are changing in the curriculum. Is that?
Yeah, correct. I mean, so it really is sort of basically a team. It has always been a team. So one individual cannot dictate what the curriculum is going to be. Most of it's determined by committees or, as I said, outside groups, which tell us what we need to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And it's important because that's how we integrate things. Another important thing is, too, you don't really have a curriculum which is driven by one person or by an individual who has just sort of one goal in mind.
Okay. And so you were saying the committees kind of respond to certain things in the curriculum. So if students are performing exceptionally well or you need to fill gaps in knowledge, are you changing things based on exam scores? Are you changing things based on certain scores of certain questions in exams? Or are you looking at like board exams and or all of that? Is that it's just all encompassing?
That's actually a great question. I would say all of those things. I think what people don't realize, I think students don't realize as you progress through their curriculum, you never look backwards because you never look at the changes that we put in place based on how students perform and input that we get from different student committees, because the curriculum is basically constantly changing. You're just not aware of it because you're always moving forward, and you're not, no one wants to go back to redo year one,
right?
You know, once you're in year two.
Yeah, I've already noticed there's not much looking back going on right now.
Correct.
It's all looking toward the future. So.
There you go.
So as a follow-up question to sort of what goes into developing the preclinical curriculum, whose responsibility is it to determine the structures, concepts, pathways, or level of depth we go into? And I think that was kind of covered under it's everyone's responsibility as the whole team. Is that sort of the right idea?
Correct. And it's under the organization, or I guess maybe the leadership of that central curricular authority.
Okay. Well, thank you. So I know that some schools, depending on how they structure their curriculum, some schools use NBME, the National Board of Medical Education.
Correct.
They use NBME. I think they curate their own exams. Is that right? Like NBME releases exams and says, here, you have the option to provide or to test your students with this exam. And then other schools use in-house written exams on their own material. So what is the decision between testing with NBME exams and in-house exams look like?
For a long time, all of our exams, so all of the exams through all 4 years were basically in-house exams. Then after a period of time, we slowly started to evolve in the clerkships to start using these, we used to call shelf exams, basic exams we purchase, because then it allows us to compare our students to other students from other schools. That's one reason. The second reason, it gives people practice on doing those sorts of exam questions, because those are the kind of exam questions which will appear on different step exams as you move forward. Now, one of the issues we always talked about is, should we do the same thing in years one and two? Well, one of the problems with shelf exams, let's say in the clerkships, is a shelf exam is really checking general knowledge, but it's really not checking what you're learning on the clerkship. So there's sort of a gap there. So as we looked back at years one and two, what we decided was the exams that we provide give us a pretty good indication how people will perform when they take the first licensing exam. That's step one, which you do at the end of year two. So we didn't feel we needed to change them, plus we have more control over them. Plus it allows us to give specific feedback to the course directors as well as students, which the shelf exams really don't. They give sort of generic information, which really doesn't help drive the curriculum at all. So that's our primary reason for continuing to use those exams. Another thing we know too is we talk to students who perform well on step one. They all tell us that the reason they perform well on step one is they basically just followed the curriculum. They paid attention to the curriculum, what we were teaching, because we were preparing them very well for that exam. And the final thing is that we, based on a lot of statistics that we did before this, we know on each exam what is a passing score, not only a passing score on the exam, but that passing score is correlated with a high probability of you doing well when you take step one. So really, if you think about it, really all the exams you're given years one and two are really prepping you or preparing you for progression through the curriculum. I mean, I know they don't feel that way because you're taking an exam. Nobody wants to take an exam, but it really sort of tells you where you're at, you know, and whether you are getting the material or not getting the material, you know, whether you're progressing adequately or not, and also gives you a chance to calibrate yourself. So if you study hard on an exam, let's say, and you just reach the passing level, then you know you're having a little bit of a problem or difficulty, may need some help. And just vice versa, if you don't study much at all and you just, you know, kind of pass through, then it tells you that you either know the material, you're sort of doing okay. So that self-calibration is another sort of reason that we're sort of kept with them.
Yeah, I don't think a medical school without exams would be beneficial to really anybody. You'd lose out on data points for you to change the curriculum, and then also the students wouldn't really have an understanding of where they sit in how they're going to perform in a future really important exam like a step exam. So
correct.
I know also, like with curricula, at certain medical schools, they follow what I guess can be considered a more traditional curriculum. Here at Stritch, I know our curriculum kind of follows this. During the first year, we're going to learn about a healthy patient. Here's what normal physiology should look like. And then the second year, we really start to dive into disease. And I think the entire year is basically, let's talk about the physiology when things go wrong. And so how do you decide between a curriculum like that, which is stereotypically a little more traditional, versus some more systems-based or integrated curricula that there may be at other schools?
Yeah, and, you know, again, that's a great question, because of all the medical schools, each medical school theoretically has the ideal curriculum. So what we decided to do here is we wanted to make the first year discipline-specific. So meaning when you're doing a thing, you're sort of doing a thing. You're sort of focused on that. And the way we structured even the beginning of the curriculum was to use the first course, the molecular cell biology, which everybody sort of has some experience clients with as a way of both helping people feel comfortable with medical school in general, sort of adjust to it. And our hidden curriculum there is that we really want to sort of build team-based learning and getting people to kind of work together because, I mean, that's basically medical education and medicine in general. So that's how we decided on that. We decided then to slowly ramp up the curriculum again to give people a chance to sort of get used to things. And that's why we're sort of like sticking sort of with that curriculum. The second year is basically truly integrated. You know, again, it's really sort of a pathophysiology, pharmacology course. And we felt that at that point in time, then it makes the most sense to do something integrated because you need all that core knowledge in year one. And it basically helps you, I think, to progress through year two better. And it seems to work much better for the students that we bring into Loyola. So that's where we sort of stuck with that as a type of a curriculum. But again, if you look at every school does something different. Outcomes are almost always the same, so they don't differ. So now one is better than the other.
Right. So most schools have a good STEP score passing rate and very good graduation rates, and the people who leave that school end up in a good position to train as physicians and all that. So the outcomes are generally always very, very good. So
correct.
It's just a matter of the sort of little differences. But yeah, from some of the second years I've talked to, it sounds like they have a completely integrated curriculum in that they take pharmacology and they're talking about lungs and meds that you would give for lung diseases while talking about diseases in like a physiology sense of what goes wrong in the lungs. And it's all sort of integrated into one. And so
correct.
I'll just have to be excited and wait for that, I guess.
There you go. Well, you can get excited now too. So don't wait till the second year.
No, every day is exciting. So how do you decide the pace of materials presented to students? I could see how maybe it's just like, here's what we need to teach you, and here's the time we have, and it's just going to be fast. Or is there something that you step back and you say, well, let's give them more lectures on this material because this is really integral, and then other material that you're like, okay, let's maybe just give them the high-level material on this one because it's not as integral.
Yeah, and you know that's always, I think, a good point because we're trying to structure a curriculum that does really two things simultaneously. One, you have to pass the step exam, that licensing exam. That's just a reality. The second thing is we really need to prepare you for your clerkships, which is why we sort of structure the pace of how we give material and what we give. And we're always sort of removing stuff and adding little, you know, different pieces in there to help. One of the big things we've been trying to do is to look at the reality of what we're trying to do here, because in reality, you're not going to get a degree in being a medical student, okay? You're going to become a physician. So we want to prepare you to enter a residency program, which is what our focus is. Because in essence, everyone who enters medical school will get through, and everyone who gets through usually gets a residency program. So you really don't have much to measure there. Where we measure our outcomes is how do people score, what do residency programs think of them after they graduate? So there we're actually doing quite well. And because our focus is, again, is preparing you to become that resident and transitioning you from what it was like to be in college and graduate school to this. So it's, again, it's a different environment. And we always say that what it took you to get into medical school is not what it takes you to finish medical school. So you have to kind of like change gears a little bit, a little bit of a different focus. Part of that focus is on a team. Part of that focus is on learning how to communicate better, how to work within a group of individuals. So you can't be solo anymore. And for some people, they're used to being solo. They're used to being like locked in a room studying all the time. But so we're trying to develop those skills and those skill sets to ensure that when you step out of here, you're very comfortable, you know, when people start calling you doctor.
Right. And I mean, I think I can attest that there's been a lot of group learning going on from the very beginning of our medical school journey. It's apparent that it's within the curriculum, both in a way that is at first purposeful in that we are required to be here to do group learning activities, but that I think transitions eventually to let's learn as a group even when we're not necessarily being required to do so. So yeah, that's been working out. So we fill out class evaluations after every class, as I'm sure many other medical students at other schools do as well. What do you do with this data, and how often would you say a class is adjusted based on the feedback from students?
Yeah, boy, that's another great question. I would say almost always, because what ends up happening is that after the end of each course in years one and two, we actually pull together a group of students who then actually look at the student comments, provide other suggestions for the course, and then they meet with the course director to provide them that feedback. The second aspect is the CCA requires each course every year and every 3 years, it's a bigger review, to kind of look through their curriculum and look at student performance, and they have to tell them, are they going to change something, do something a little bit differently, which might be an exam, which may be getting rid of some content, adding some additional content. So that information is really integrated in kind of like an everyday process. Another thing that I think students should be aware of is all those comments that you put in about faculty get automatically pulled into the annual faculty evaluations. Each faculty member has all those comments within this document that they review with their chair. So even that input is important, and it's used to identify faculty who are having problems with education or teaching, but also to provide some positive feedback for faculty who are doing a good job, to know that they are doing a good job, because that just kind of motivates you that way too. So all that data is made use of both for faculty, because that's used for their promotions, as well as, again, for the curriculum. So again, it's almost a kind of a continuous sort of like review and look at it, what we're doing and the outcomes.
I mean, from a student perspective, you would have no clue how much goes into developing this. A lot of thought put through before integrating something into the curriculum, I'm sure. So just as some background, the LCME, what does that stand for?
It's a Liaison Committee for Medical Education.
Okay. And I was looking previously to this interview about their accreditation standards, and I think it's been a talk here recently because we're up for reaccreditation. And I was noticing that like the standards themselves that I was finding online seem very broad. These sort of topics around like who should be involved in medical education and resources that are available to students and study spaces and all this stuff. And then I did find like one section on curricular content, and it also looked kind of broad, as in like teach them biological concepts. And I'm wondering how much is the curriculum that's developed shaped by the standards that are outlined by the LCME?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that one, we have to do that. So we have to kind of follow, you know, sort of their standards. But what we do and how we do it can vary. And so it varies from school to school. So that does form some of the curriculum we do, how we teach, how we evaluate, how we assess things. So we do have to align with that. But again, how we do it and how much we do and everything is sort of up to us. Because if you look in there, and if you look under clinical stuff, they don't tell you how many patients you should see or how many hearts you should examine or, you know, eyes you should look into, mm-hmm. which is sort of interesting, you know, when you consider, I mean, that's your clinical training. You would think there'd be some average or whatever, but none of that's there. So we have to determine that. So we determine what disorders, what diseases should you see or encounter when you're on your clerkships. And that also feeds back into years one and two, what we teach. And again, what's happening now and more recently is that we're getting feedback on how our graduates perform in their residency programs. Before, we would try to get there through surveys. But, you know, typical survey, you're lucky if you get 10% of people who respond back. But now the American Medical Association and the ACGME, that's the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education. They're the people who basically are the accrediting people for residency programs. They're starting to provide school-specific feedback. So all of our graduates, how they perform in that first year is fed back to the school. So if you ask me, what they're trying to develop is a continuum of sort of education and performance. So again, if almost everybody graduates from medical school, but then they don't perform well as residents, well, that may impact that medical school. Mm-hmm. So we find that information very helpful to us. And that's information which is sort of driving a lot of the curricular changes we make, is to make sure that you perform well as a resident, you know, as well as, again, yes, you have to pass licensing exams, you know, so sort of a twofer that we're working hard to make sure we continue to accomplish.
So even the information that you're getting from residents that finish their first year and fill out a survey, like that's even changing the preclinical curriculum?
Yes, definitely. You know, some of the things we began, this is a while ago, we developed a point of care ultrasound program. Mm-hmm. That was really based on the fact that was becoming a more frequent tool is being used in the clinical setting. So we decided, well, we need to sort of integrate some of that, you know, again, within our curriculum now. So sort of get an introduction years one and two, and then we kind of keep pushing it through just so that you're at least familiar with the technique and how to use it or what it's used for. So I think, again, the focus is really not just on the fact you graduate, because I mean, literally everybody graduates, but it's the fact that, you know, when you leave here, you're prepared again to become a physician, be called an MD, and to know what to do and not to freak out, mm-hmm. you know, on your first day on service, or if you have somebody who has an infection or a cough or can't breathe or chest pain or whatever, you become familiar with what to do. And that we actually are very, very good at, because the feedback that we get is that most of our residents compared to their peers are actually doing much better than them. In fact, very few are doing not as well. So that really, I think, is a positive aspect of what we're doing in the extra clinical training that you're going to be getting in years three and four.
So the outlook is good.
It's very positive. So it's rosy.
Good. So this is a rather tough question, and N equals one on this one, okay. Because I'm not sure, you know, I don't know how much other people feel this way, but I was noticing during the first few classes, sometimes we were learning material that, and this is just me, I would watch a lecture, for instance, and then I would go, okay, well, let's go compare this lecture to some sort of third-party program for step studying, for instance. And I would notice that what we had in the lecture was beyond the scope of what the third-party resources were teaching for the board exam. Overall, I understand again, like the goal of medical school is to mold us into good physicians, not necessarily just good test takers. And we've heard that previously. But obviously, we still have to pass these STEP exams. And so in this era where I would say there's arguably more testable material on these exams than is possible to know, at some point, why are we learning or being taught material that seems to go even further in depth than what would be required to reason our way through some of these STEP exam questions?
Yeah, and again, a great question. I think sometimes a great concern for students is that, you know, as a student, you sort of focus on exams. And what's happening is because like word of mouth and the noise in the environment is these STEP exams. So it almost becomes like your life's purpose is only to pass this exam, and any extra learning is not needed. So what we try to do is we try to balance both of them. One, yes, you have to pass that exam. So we have to make sure that that content is covered. And then we will make a decision or pick as to, you know, this is other relevant sort of information, which is, again, do you need to know it for probably the step? Maybe not, but does it come in handy as you start kind of pulling stuff together and just start moving through, you know, years 3 and 4? You know, there the answer is yes. So that's a rationale for adding a little bit more, because we don't want to just become a Cliff Notes school. And we don't want to become a school where everything is virtual and you just stay at home and you never come in and you just take exams. So it's always a balance. And as I said, we remove stuff, you know, we add some stuff, we remove things which we think are at a level too much for a student. But the same point too is we want to sort of like tickle your imagination with some of the sort of interesting stuff you should be aware of, without getting into, let's say, the nitty-gritty of really core basic science, you know, class 501 kind of material. So mm-hmm. It's always a balancing act. But again, those are sort of our two goals. So yes, we have to pass the exam. We're making sure you do it. And the second thing, yeah, there's some extra information, which we think is relevant and important for you to know going forward.
Yeah, and I think at times there's been things that were prefaced with sort of, here's some more information if you'd like to know it, rather than like, know this and you're going to be tested on it sort of thing. And so I could also see how like one of the thoughts that I had was like, well, if you just pigeonholed your professors into only teaching this information and they're passionate about a much broader amount of information, are you going to keep professors? Are they going to even have a passion for teaching that if you just say, no, you can't teach these things because they don't need to know it sort of thing? And so there's a balance, I think, that.
Yeah, but we do have to keep an eye on the professors because, I mean, you do tend to teach what you love and what you do.
Right.
But we have to haul them back sometimes. Actually, we have more of a problem with clinical faculty because they sort of go over, do a little bit more than what we want.
When you start to sub-specialize. And
correct. You're right. So we have to kind of pull them back and say, no, that's, you know, I mean, that's interesting, but this is the stuff we need them to get. Yeah, you can give them a little bit of this extra stuff.
Yeah, I could see that being the case. These are people working at an academic institution. Mm-hmm. They want to teach people, so. So every year there are many thousands more students that apply to medical school compared to those who are accepted. And this is the reality for most medical schools in the US. So in my head, I was thinking theoretically any of these schools could have a full class every year, even if the students weren't necessarily happy with the education they were receiving. Where we are with medical school admissions today, transferring to other schools is really uncommon. And so with this, what do you think the incentive is to change the curriculum based on students' feedback?
Oh, a great question. Because, you know, as I said, one of the goals of getting into medical school is obviously graduating. We know almost everybody's going to do that. We work hard at one to make sure that the persons we admit kind of fit the culture of the school. And really, a lot of that culture is determined by students who are already here. So a lot of the selection is by students kind of matching up to other students with how they behave and how they act and stuff like that. Is it a driving force for us to change curriculum? It's good that is not, you know, that we are driving curriculum by what you need to be as a practicing doctor. Mm-hmm. Because you're correct. I mean, if we wanted to, we could just kind of pick names from a box and, you know, those could be the people that we pick. And they would go through their curriculum not knowing if school B was better than the school they were in. So that's why, even with the admissions process, that's why it takes so long, you know, to go through. Because literally they have 12,000 applications and, you know, it ends up where they're only interviewing 500 or 600 people. So there's a lot of selection. And part of the selection is by looking at characteristics of those students who kind of like fit the school to kind of help them to make sure they feel comfortable here and it's a fit for them. You know, and the hard part about medical school and like colleges who have to discount tuition and, you know, and all this other stuff, medical schools have not had to do anything like that. The flip side is we're very lucky because the people who apply to medical school are very smart and sharp. And so it's a little bit easier. And of all the people who apply, one number to keep in mind is about half of them get into a medical school. Right. It may not be the school you want to get in, but half of them get into medical school and sort of do okay if they kind of like, you know, follow through and sort of align as best as they can, you know, with the school that they enter. I don't know if I answered your question because it's a complicated question.
No, it is, and it is a complicated question because a medical school is so unlike any other any other type of school, because not only do we have a lot of very capable people, anyone who gets into medical school is very capable and smart and hardworking, but they also really want to be here, right? Because this isn't just like, oh, I just applied and we'll see how this goes. It's very purposeful in the application process. So it's different than most schools, I think.
Well, one of the interesting things we had, because I think all of you were participants in that independent student analysis, that survey, which is going to be part of the LCME accreditation. Mm-hmm. So I was just looking through it, and I looked at that, and I also looked through the matriculation questionnaire, you know, for everybody who comes in, you know, these are sort of the questions you ask before you come in. And one of the questions was, when did you decide to go into medicine? This is going to be your field. And most of the people had decided by high school, half of them decided at by high school, maybe another 25% decided in their first couple years of college. So it's almost as if a calling which sort of finds you rather than you find it. So you're already sort of motivated with the right mindset, you know, to go into medical school, which is why I think most people who enter medical school want to stay in and, you know, want to finish and do finish. Because you're right, it's sort of, you know, what you probably always want to be and where you feel you're going to fit and really get the most out of your life and your future.
Right. I think it'll be interesting to see how, if that changes as sort of the average age of medical school matriculants gets higher and people start taking more gap years, you know, I think we're getting more non-traditional students, but do we see a lower number of people who are like, I was born to do this and I knew my freshman year of high school that I was going to go into medicine, and maybe more of like, I had to figure it out and work a couple jobs and, you know, like a little different way of, I think at this point, it's becoming a more common way that people are ending up here. I know that this year, my class's average age is higher than it's ever been, so it's an interesting transition. So through researching for this episode, I came across a couple of schools that have different preclinical curricula than most. Some of these schools are true pass-fail for all 4 years, with no internal ranking, no honors, and oftentimes, sometimes few required in-person activities, with more emphasis put on self-directed studying. And I know we talked about this a little bit. The goal is to get people together and work as a team. But I was just thinking that the sort of true pass-fail, no internal ranking, no honors, everyone at like the same sort of level doesn't seem like a leap from many curricula, including our own. But what would you say like gets in the way of a school saying, okay, let's make this transition from pass-fail, honors, high honors, to something similar to like these curriculum?
A couple of things. One, students, because all of you are very competitive. All of you are type A personalities. Almost all of you have done exceedingly well wherever you've been. So you've never been sort of in the lower end of the quartile system. And the second thing is residency programs. Residency programs need some way to determine if a person is sort of ready for the program. So they need some sort of a marker. And in fact, most residency programs, again, aren't really that concerned about your grades or anything in years one and two, which is why most schools have gone to pass-fail in that. That was one reason. The second reason is we thought that it would relieve some of the stress and anxiety that a lot of students go through, which is why the first licensing exam went to pass-fail. But what we've seen with that, it's almost as if as that one stress was removed, the stress moved downstream. So not everybody's concerned about step two, how they perform and everything else like that. So I think part of it is that you still have to sort of stratify people. You have to kind of determine, you know, where they're performing at and what level they're performing at, because different specialties do have different requirements or expectations. So I don't think it will be very easy to kind of get beyond that. The second thing is that some schools pick individuals just on the basis of their MCAT. Mm-hmm. So they say they're pass-fail, yeah, but every student they admit has an MCAT of 520. I mean, test-wise, they're going to do just fine, period. They probably never have to come to school. They maybe could be completely virtual. But again, I think for us, we're looking for individuals who fulfill or who align most with our mission, what we're trying to do, trying to accomplish. Again, it really is the whole individual. And the other thing, too, is again, I think where they miss out is that all of your life as a physician, you're going to be part of a group of individuals. You are not going to be alone. And I think as you work as a team, what you start finding is that everybody's performance improves. Even the best person in the group performs better by being in a team. Mm-hmm. So another reason why I think some of the schools who do that is not helpful. And as I said, going from our grading system in years three or four, the clerkships to pass-fail was something we've discussed for a long time. We had a lot of pushback from students saying they needed some way to distinguish themselves. Mm-hmm. And we also had some pushback from residency programs because they said, we just don't want to rely only on a step score. You want to see, how did that individual perform on these different clerkships? So we do, you know, kind of stratify people. But remember, we're stratifying, you know, the top couple percent of people in the country. So, you know, to me, it's when I watch the Olympic Games and you have all these, you know, swimmers that are all, and you say, well, that person came in number 10. Well, that person probably swims better than almost every other individual in the world,
right,
even coming in number 10. So that's where all of you are. But we still have to kind of try to find some way to kind of help support that number one to number 10.
Right. I guess it comes back down to there will always be a lot more people trying to get into medical school than get into medical school. So it just becomes, and same thing, I guess, with residency, there are more people wanting to get in than will get in. And so even if you're the Olympic metaphor of a medical student, there still maybe needs to be something. But then as an offshoot of step one, going pass fail, which is relatively recent.
Correct.
What was that transition like, you know, as someone who was working with a team that was involved in changing the curriculum and hearing that, okay, well, this previously scored exam that could have some bearing on your residency application is now pass fail. And so I think I've seen that our curriculum is a little more condensed in sort of the first half. So was that a really challenging transition?
Yeah, well, yeah, yes, it was, because we decided, again, because our focus is on you becoming a physician, we wanted to put more of your education into the clinical part of the curriculum. So not, you know, not the preclinical, not those first 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So for us to do that, that has been going on for like 5 or 6 years. We've been moving stuff around, cutting stuff out, you know, deciding what is the stuff you really need for step one and what is the stuff you really need to start your clerkships. So that's why we were able to compress it. Now, we're not the first medical school to do this. In fact, more and more schools are doing this. So it's not a brand new idea. And as they look at performance of students, they find that their performance is the same when they take step one and step two. It really doesn't differ. The other thing to remember is that in your first 2 years, you also sort of end up with a number. When you take an exam or a test or whatever, there's sort of always a number there. So you can kind of get an idea as to how you're performing.
Mm-hmm.
But you sort of use that number for your own calibration, not how am I performing against the rest of the class, but when I do this or do that, this is kind of the score that I get to help you to determine what are the study skills or things you need to change or modify so that you are more successful without trying to just put in more hours to become a little more efficient, you know, and effective in what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So do I see this as ever going all 4 years, just pass, fail? Probably not. I think it's important, and I think that's what makes our students very competitive in residency programs, is they can see what happens. Another thing we know, too, is that most of the individuals, and this has been for a while, do a lot better on step two than you do on step one. It's not just because we give you shelf exams, you know, through all your clerkships. It's because you're learning a lot in that clinical setting, which then, you know, translates to you doing better on step two.
Gotcha. So we've talked a little bit about these sort of new evaluations that are being received from residents to sort of figure out how to adapt or how to change the curriculum, even through all 4 years, I'm sure. But like beyond people filling out evaluations like that, are you aware of any research that suggests that the way that most schools teach med students is the correct way to go about it? Or essentially, like, is a lot of what we're learning sort of evidence-based in that, like, people have gone through and said, well, if we change this in the curriculum, then we get a worse outcome. If we change this in the curriculum, we get a better outcome, sort of thing. Or are we kind of running off of status quo and things have been this way, and so they kind of continue to be this way?
I think, one, we do have to get beyond the status quo, because you're correct. You know, when you're doing well, what's the rationale to change? You know, why try something different? There is some evidence-based information as to how you should teach or what you should teach or how you should assess things, which is why we're actually one of the first schools in the state here, maybe in the country, actually started doing standardized patients and all that other clinical training,
mm-hmm,
to sort of prepare people a lot faster. And the other sort of goal for that is to make sure that when you do start on your clerkships, you're sort of prepared to be in that environment. So you feel comfortable doing histories and actually start developing more skill doing physical examinations and stuff. So the evidence that's out there we use. The difficulty is, as I said, because there's over 150 medical schools, everybody does something a little bit different. You know, again, the outcomes are the same. So really sort of adjusting to the students we bring in and sort of the overall goals that we want to achieve. And again, that's actually measured through, it's actually not residents evaluating themselves, but it's their program directors,
okay,
evaluating them.
Gotcha.
And feeding that,
right,
information back. Because, be honest with you, everybody thinks they're doing wonderful, right? You know, until you take an exam or somebody else assesses you. Exactly.
You need an honest assessment.
Unbiased assessment, and that's the information that we use. So,
right, okay. But there's a push for change, and it's not just it's not just staying at like, well, it's working, so let's keep doing it the way we're doing it. Are there people who are in academia that study that? I mean, I know there's like a my previous workplace, there was a push for this. There was a lot of people doing med ed fellowships and people doing med ed research, but I didn't see as much of it in like preclinical. You know, a lot of it was like, well, how can we best teach students in their clinical years how to be good practitioners and how to do that sort of thing? Rather than like, I didn't see a lot of med ed trained physicians being like, let's go back to the preclinical and really do a deep dive into the preclinical years. And are there people in that area of expertise that are doing that?
Correct. Yeah. And it's not so much the teaching, but it's how can we change the environment to optimize it for learning, you know, which is sort of the goal. A lot of that is based on providing feedback. A lot of that is based on active kind of discussions, which is why almost all schools now have a large section of their curriculum, which is just pre-recorded.
Right.
Because we found that really sitting in a lecture is kind of nice because it's sort of a very passive way where you think you're learning, but you're really not. So we're kind of moving away from that and kind of pushing more things for small group discussions where it's a little more uncomfortable because it's a little more stressful because, you know, you may not know the answer. There's like sets of gray and stuff you have to deal with, but it's actually the optimal way for you to develop the skill sets, you know, that you need to be more effective learners. So most of, I think, the educational research is really based on that. Changing the learning environment to make it more effective for learning, skill development, you know, which you carry along. Now, one thing to be honest with you, too, is another skill we're trying to teach people is how to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have time now to experiment and practice in years one and two as to what do I need to do to, like, refresh myself? How much sleep do I need? What other things do I need to do? Because that's what you're going to carry forward in your clerkships because you got to figure out how am I going to do it there? And that's what you're going to carry forward in your when you leave and you enter a residency program. So part of it is really skill set. You know, learning is another kind of focus of what we're trying to do.
So it's even beyond just learning the material, but rather sitting there in year one and saying, here's what I need to maintain my sanity and to make sure that I'm ready to learn. Maybe I need exercise or maybe I need enough sleep. And then that's going to be a much more challenging thing to come by in third and fourth year, and especially in residency. And so if you put a lot of emphasis on that early on, then that's something that someone can continue doing throughout their training and career, I'm sure.
Correct. Yeah. And you carry it forward, you know, right out there to your outside of the school.
So this is the last question for you. I'm almost done bombarding you. So you as the Vice Dean for Education, what changes do you see being made in the near future for medical education?
Yeah. You know, probably two things. The first thing is remember, most of your education is not a simulation. Most of your education occurs in a clinical workplace. So in a clinical workplace, the emphasis there is on efficiency, effectiveness, and everything else like that. So to integrate students into that environment, we've got to make sure that you're ready and prepared. Because if you introduce someone who's not very effective or efficient, you slow down the whole team. So part of it, I think, is we're trying to move forward to is to making sure that you are more effective and efficient in entering. So you don't slow down a team. They welcome you to the team. And then you actually add, you know, benefit to it. Because, again, it's not a simulation. Basically, it's a sort of a work environment, you know, which you're going to have to fit into. We're doing that through different things. We're doing it through different sort of experiments. We're trying to see what works, what doesn't work. Everything from getting people used to electronic medical record on, you know, how to check a blood pressure and stuff like that. So my hope, my dream, my plan is to eventually get all of the first years and all of the second years. During the time that you're here, you will be working in a 1 half-day clinic a week, bringing patients in the room, checking their blood pressure, getting their HPI, in essence, practicing.
Right.
You know, and getting that skill set. So again, when you move into the third year, everybody wants a student in clinic because they just add to their efficiency. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. The second thing is how do you assess learning and everything else like that? And we're sort of a test-centric society in general. But now that AI is coming into play, systems and all these test banks and data banks are going to have a run for their money because pretty soon people are going to be able to generate thousands of questions, which you can test yourself on. You can adjust them to your own performance. So pretty soon, you know, the cost of doing that is going to drop down, I think, pretty significantly. And it'll become more of a program which will really be sort of personified for you, for your needs. So as you get tested, if you don't know how that heart muscle works, then more questions will appear with that until you do well.
That sounds amazing, actually.
Yeah. So and we're there right now. I mean, so people are already doing this. So pretty soon that's going to be in place. So that'll help make your learning more personal, you know, adjust to what you need. So I think those are going to be, you know, one thing, the clinical environment. The second thing, you know, will be how do you study? How do you learn? And how do you basically define what you need to learn? Because, I mean, that I think would be the most useful thing. So really, if you really know something, why do you don't need to spend more time on it? But these other topics you may, and you'll be able to pretty soon do that.
Right. Yeah. Fantastic. Either way, it sounds like good things to come in the future. So.
Yeah. Only positiveness. Only.
That's right. Always.
That's right. Only unicorns and rainbows.
Of course. Well, Dr. Gruner, thank you so much for taking the time. This has been a very insightful experience, and I'm glad that we were able to sit down and pick your brain on some of these questions that I've had over the past one semester so far. Only 7 more to go.
Great. And I hope it's helpful to other people too.
Yeah, I'm sure. Thank you so much. And with that, we'll wrap this episode of Medicus. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this episode. This wouldn't be possible without the support from our listeners. Please rate, review, and subscribe. We appreciate donations to help fund the production of this podcast. To support us, go to medicuspodcast.com, where you can additionally find show notes, links, and information about our guests. We are at Medicus Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. If you have any questions, comments, or episode suggestions, please submit them on our website. This podcast is intended for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine. No patient-doctor relation is formed, and the content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Views and opinions are their own and do not represent any organization.